Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Not good, bad, and crazy martinis for conservatives, as usual. Special format today with the news that there appears to be at least a Senate agreement between Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell on the formula for passing a continuing resolution, also raising the debt ceiling, both of those into early next year. There'll be some other details they'll be announcing shortly after we record this. And so Jim has cleverly entitled today's podcast, "What Have We Learned, Charlie Brown," from this particular standoff over the past several weeks. This will kind of be just a ping pong back and forth, more informal conversation with a little less structure than usual. So, Jim, take it away.
This is what happens when, you know, news breaks around the time of the taping of the Three Martini Lunch. We can probably come up with a couple basics of this. Among them, if we're looking for a good martini, I think it's good that we're not going to hit the debt ceiling. I think it's good that we're not going to default. There are quite a few readers of National Review, and I wouldn't be surprised if quite a few listeners of Radio America who basically believe that default is not that bad, that a lot of this has been overhyped by the media or overhyped by the administration. As mentioned in the Morning Jolt today, well, you know, theoretically, we wouldn't really be defaulting because we still have some tax revenue coming in. And the answer is yes, we could. Eventually, you run out of cash, and I mean like literally cash on hand to pay for things like Social Security checks or the military or even the parts of the government that are not shut down. So yeah, you can move money around for a couple of days, but that's really not going to save the day or be much of a long-term solution. At some point, more money is due to go out than there is to come in. And that is at what point the government stops paying its debts. We haven't paid our interest, and that's default. The good news is the markets are feeling better, and we are starting to see a sense that the worst-case scenario has been averted. I know there are some folks who really seem to think we're going to have to, you know, stop spending sometime, so we might as well tear off the Band-Aid and go through a default and suffer all the economic chaos that would flow forth from that. I don't buy into that. I think the U.S. government not paying its debts is a bad thing, and that I am, you know, one of those things where as bad as it is to borrow money, it is bad to say, you know, not pay money you owe and then have the deadbeat reputation that comes with that and the difficulty of borrowing money ever again. So that's the sliver of good news that comes out of this. The bad news is that I think, you know, later today, the Senate will pass and the House will pass a deal that Republicans probably could have gotten 3 weeks ago and not have taken the hit for the government shutdown and not have at least partially obscured the horrific rollout of the Obamacare exchanges and not have had a great deal of infighting and not have had collateral damage of the gubernatorial bid of Ken Cuccinelli. You know, I think a lot of bad things have come out of this fight for the right. I am not really convinced that you can point to some sort of moral victory or some sort of benefit from the fight over the last 2 or 3 weeks. Greg, I would welcome someone's attempt to talk me out of it.
I would not say that Ken Cuccinelli is in dire straits in Virginia as a result of the government shutdown. I think it's added to his existing woes, which were A, being badly outfunded, and B, a state party that doesn't like him. And so they just decided to throw a hissy fit this year and not help him win. But back to the government shutdown, I think the ultimate idea of making a big deal out of Obamacare was a good idea. I think the strategy was a bit flawed. I think they should have laid the groundwork for this sooner, which was partially hindered by all the attention towards Syria in mid-September. So they got a little bit of a late start. The argument, I think, for the one-year delay, given what the administration's already done, was the better starting point than defunding. Starting earlier also would have given them more time to incrementally lower their demands, from delay to a medical device tax to everybody plays by the same rules, that sort of thing. Because when they ran them all together within a span of about 24 to 48 hours, it just blurred past Americans. They didn't understand what those were, and they just knew they were headed towards a government shutdown. So I think they probably should have ended this a little bit sooner than they did. I think it's okay that the shutdown happened because we saw a lot of President Obama's true character coming out of this and his petty, punitive harassing of Americans trying to go about national parks and monuments and other sorts of things. The fact that there were a lot of Republicans ready to just roll over and accept existing spending levels with no debate whatsoever about Obamacare because they knew they didn't have the votes to pass any of this stuff, that's really depressing. The fact that you don't want to stand up and make an argument. You were sent there to do a job in Washington, and just because you don't have the votes doesn't mean you don't stand up and make the argument. How you resolve the standoff when you don't have the votes is another issue. It reminds me of a really liberal movie, An American President, where Michael Douglas was kind of the Bill Clinton figure, saying that it was nobody's business, the scandal he was in, his personal scandal. American people, there was none of their business, and so he wasn't going to fight. And Martin Sheen, who was his chief of staff, says, you don't just fight the fights you can win. You fight the fights that need fighting. And this is a fight that the conservatives and the Tea Partiers decided that it was really important to wage. The establishment Republicans had no intention of doing that whatsoever. You've got folks who are just saying, well, we didn't win the last election, so not even going to bring it up.
Greg, very rarely do I disagree as strongly with you I do on this segment, because there is not a single House Republican and there is not a single Senate Republican who does not oppose Obamacare and that doesn't want to fight Obamacare. And in fact, I actually think everything was perfectly fine with Ted Cruz's quasi-filibuster. The problem is that the leverage that was designed as a form of getting Obama to move in their direction was the government shutdown, with the implied threat of doing the same thing for the debt ceiling. Except Obama, as I wrote in the Morning Joel today, Obama thinks he wins the government shutdown. Now, is Obama getting some of the blame for this government shutdown? Sure, but you know, the Republicans are taking a bigger hit in the polls. You say this reveals some of Obama's character. I would love to see some American who was pro-Obama before this week, but changed their views as a result of, say, shutting down the World War II memorial. If you're not convinced of Obama's character by now, I don't think a particular National Park Service action is going to change your mind on that. We see this guy as a cynical operator who's willing to let the country go to pot so that he gets his way and he gets his policies enacted. He was perfectly willing to deal with the government shutdown as long as he got to keep Obamacare. The negotiation stance we've seen for the last couple of days indicates Barack Obama was perfectly fine with defaulting on the debt as long as he got to keep Obamacare. So in a way, you know, Obama has the bigger hostage, that he's willing to actually inflict more pain on the country so that he gets what he wants. The other reflection of this is that there has been we don't have a House majority. We really have three House minorities. We have the House Democrats, who are pretty darn unified. Maybe 20 of them can be picked off on the right circumstances, maybe 30. You have of the Republican caucus, probably about 40, if you want to qualify them as the Tea Party caucus, you know, you can call them that. Certainly they were enough to scuttle the deal that was being discussed last night, which they could not garner 218 votes for the House to put forth its own option, its own counterproposal instead of the Senate one. And then, of course, you've got the remainder of the House Republicans, which is probably in the neighborhood of about 170, 180 or so. John Boehner isn't really Speaker of the House. He doesn't have 218 votes who will line up behind him when the chips are down and when, you know, in the really high profile votes. And as a result of that, he is a wounded speaker. The problem is I don't see any figure who could replace Boehner and then unify at least 218 of these Republicans. So for at least the remainder of this Congress, and probably for, you know, until some other figure comes along who can unify the Peter Kings as well as the Scott Garretts and Michelle Bachmans of the world, you have a circumstance in which the House Republican caucus has become too fractured to function as a majority. And at this point, that pretty much puts Harry Reid in the driver's seat of getting legislation through Congress.
I think Boehner deserves credit. Some Tea Party supporters aren't going to like that. But I think he did the best he could to respond to the more conservative wing of the Republican conference and tried to accommodate as much as possible. And it was a difficult balancing act based on previous debt ceiling negotiations. He pretty much told him to pound sand back in 2011. And so the main point that I'm trying to make here is that even though the numbers simply weren't there, to just wait for the next time that Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the White House to do anything about this or to even make a lot of noise about this, Republicans controlled those three things from 2003 to 2007. The last time they controlled everything before that was the Eisenhower administration. So there's a good chance that opportunity is not going to be around for decades. And so to not make noise until all the ducks are in a row just doesn't seem like the smartest way to go about it.
All perfectly fine to make noise. And you think back, the Republicans probably could have endured a 2-3, maybe even 4 days of a government shutdown before it really would start hitting their numbers. Most of Washington can operate with a couple of days before this, you know, paychecks start getting missed. Basically, after about 3 or 4 days is when Hagel ordered the civilian DOD workers to come back. So all of these things that the Republicans thought of as leverage could have been leverage at a certain point. And then there's kind of this tipping point at which point it does more damage to Republicans than it does to congressional Democrats or to President Obama.
Agreed.
Problem was that if you, at that point, you needed an exit strategy. You marched into the Box Canyon, you charged the guns, it didn't work, and then what do? The last week have kind of been this tumultuous back and forth of what was the Republicans' internal red line. You know, what was the thing they needed to hold on to in order to reopen the government and raise the debt ceiling? For a while, it looked like it was going to be the medical device manufacturer tax. Just yesterday, it was this very interesting argument coming forth that actually this was a trap for Republicans. That as much as we on the right hate the medical device manufacturer tax, if you do this, the argument will be Republicans shut down the government in order to protect big businesses. Some medical device manufacturers are big businesses. Some of them are small businesses. But there's a certain argument that says of all the problems in Obamacare, the individual mandate, the higher premiums people are going to have, the higher deductibles, is the device tax really the biggest problem? Or is this a matter of Republicans responding to which group has the most lobbyists on K Street? That's ultimately, I understand, according to the reporting of Bob Costa, one of the things that scuttled the House proposal last night. Some Republicans being incredulous at their colleagues not wanting to repeal a tax and not wanting to repeal a tax that they had criticized since it was enacted back when Obamacare passed. Having said that, of all the things in Obamacare you want to change, is the medical device tax the first step? If you do that, you end up taking all these medical device manufacturers who, you know, and their lobbyists, and you take them out of the game as a force against Obamacare. There's a certain school of thought amongst a lot of folks on the right who's like, look, I'll live under Obamacare as long as there's no exceptions, because it's such a mess and such a disaster. You're more likely to build momentum for a total repeal than by doing this piecemeal tweaking of it and, you know, exempting certain folks and stuff like that. So like most people, I'm kind of, you know, of the attitude of, look, if this country refuses to get rid of Obamacare and refuses to put enough pressure on enough Democrats to get them to vote for repeal of Obamacare, then we need to enact every last bit of Obamacare, and we need the suffering to be widespread and intense to make sure the Democrats pay a severe price for this. And I think that's got to be the plan going forward. Get out of this fight and get into a fight on better ground.
I think that this should have ended sooner, and I think they had a good opportunity to do it, because you had the issue, a very high-profile one that people react to viscerally, with the veterans at the memorials. But once you were into like day three or four and you knew that this Obamacare exchange rollout was a complete disaster, go ahead and let that be your argument going forward, and let that be seen by the American people distraction-free by fiscal debates in Washington, even if you just kicked it down the road a few weeks or a couple months or whatever it turns out being here. So we're going to have the fight again in a few weeks, a couple months from now, start of next year. But very, very interesting.
We'll probably go back to regular format tomorrow, folks. But this is, you know, this is basically reflecting a lot of discussions that are going on the right these days. And I think this has turned out to be a largely unproductive period of time for the right. And so I think it's back to the drawing board and think about, all right, how do we best battle in a hopefully soon to be post-shutdown, post-debt ceiling fight, Obamacare world? How do you conduct this fight heading into 2014?
Jim, have a great day. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Looking forward to tomorrow, Greg. See you.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.